James Madison University is a marvelous public institution of higher education located in the beautiful Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. And that location is important because, you see, it's just across the mountain from the Virginia Piedmont, where Montpelier is located. And hey, if you've got a university named after James Madison and it's not very far from Montpelier, which underwrites this show, well, it's just a natural fit, isn't it, that I should go there and visit a little bit with them and maybe even work together in presenting a really cool presentation. And guess what? That's just what I did recently. And we'll hear a little bit of that presentation today, but what we're mostly going to hear is a conversation I had with JMU's president. His name is Jonathan R. Alger. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about a conversation with the Quiz Prez.
Your Weekly Constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
If you're a regular listener, you'll know that several years ago, I sat down with a fellow by the name of Jonathan R. Alger, the president, at that time, the brand new president of James Madison University in Virginia. And we spoke about, had a very interesting conversation about affirmative action, which is a topic he knows a great deal about. But recently, I was back on the JMU campus, and I was there at John's invitation to give a presentation in something they call their Madison Vision Series. A little bit more about that later. But another thing I did while I was at JMU is I sat down again with John to talk to him about his vision for his great university.
I'm John Alger. I'm the president of James Madison University here in Harrisonburg, Virginia. It's an exciting place to be. We are a public institution with about 20,000 students, mostly undergraduates. And
wow.
I'm a lawyer by training, so I've...
Wait a minute, a lawyer? You left the dark side, and you came here to spread enlightenment.
That's a nice way to put it. Yes, I've started my career actually in private practice and then worked at the U.S. Department of Education for a while and really developed a passion for the mission of education. And so I worked there, the American Association of University Professors, and then at the Universities of Michigan and at Rutgers on a wide variety of higher education issues.
We met shortly after you ascended to your exalted position, and you had a very interesting past that you've just alluded to when you worked in the counsel's office, the general counsel's office at the University of Michigan. At a pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. So why don't you, let's just briefly recap what we talked about last time.
Well, back in 2003, there were two cases from the University of Michigan that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, known as the Grotz and Grutter cases. They deal with the issue of affirmative action, specifically the consideration of race as one of many factors in the admissions process and whether or not that is constitutional. The university's argument was that it was necessary to achieve the educational benefits of a diverse student body. So those two cases, one a challenge to the undergraduate admissions policy, the other to the law school admissions policy, both went up simultaneously to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And they are, between the two of them, probably the two most currently important affirmative action cases. And by that, I mean, there are obviously other important cases out there. But when we spoke just a couple of years ago, they were still the latest and greatest expressions of what affirmative action higher education could be. And the outcome, of course, again, was that the undergraduate admissions program was considered too mechanistic. Mm-hmm. Too rigid. It was a point system and it was rejected because effectively it excluded some people from being considered. And the law school admissions program was the more holistic, which mm-hmm. the court had almost approved earlier in the Bakke case.
Right.
And that sort of affirmed for the first time what people had thought Bakke meant. So a holistic review, considering all factors where everybody gets considered and everything, including race, can be considered. Those were approved, and that was back in 2005, or was it three?
2003.
And the reason we were talking about it this last time I was here was because affirmative action is really sort of, well, I hesitate to say under assault, but mm-hmm. Certainly proponents feel it's that way because the court has changed since 2003.
Yes, it has. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, was the key swing vote back in 2003, and she indeed wrote the key majority opinion in the Grutter case that affirmed the concept that diversity is a compelling interest in higher education. So now that she's no longer on the court, Justice Kennedy is considered the key swing vote now, and the composition of the court indeed has changed. You, of course, have a different Chief Justice. And to add to the mix, we now have a new case, the Fisher case coming out of the University of Texas, that is back in front of the Supreme Court on what I'd like to think is a narrower question.
We talked about Fisher last time because it was going up last time.
We did.
But it kind of came back in a way that was less than satisfying. It was, they did something called remanding it, right?
Right.
They sent it back for further factual review. Then they get to what you were just about to talk about.
Yeah, so people may remember in Texas, what they did is they developed something called a percent plan for admissions in the University of Texas system, saying that students within the top 10% of their graduating classes would be admitted into the University of Texas system. The idea is that that would help to achieve diversity, frankly, in part because they had highly segregated school districts in Texas. So some that were majority white, some that were majority African American, and still others that were majority Hispanic or Latino. So a percent plan almost by definition would produce a certain level of diversity in the university system. The question for Texas after the Michigan cases was whether on top of that plan, they could also consider race as a factor if they deemed it to be necessary to achieve their educational goals with regard to diversity. That's what Texas did after the Michigan cases. They said, we still believe it's necessary for us to consider race as one of many factors to some extent to achieve a diverse student body. And the question now is, did they do enough to look at all of the different so-called race-neutral alternatives to show that it was necessary to add race as a factor?
So they're sort of adding burdens to that. They're saying before you consider race as an alternative, you got to consider all these other race-neutral alternatives that are designed to increase diversity. And when you ratchet up standards like that, that's kind of a more subtle way of effectively changing the policy.
Right. And I think that's part of the concern is that even if the court doesn't go so far as to overrule the fundamental premise that, yes, diversity is a compelling interest, you can make it so difficult in practice for schools to meet the burdens that they'll say, look, it just isn't worth the effort. It's too difficult to make this case.
Right. And before we leave this, and I realize it's not the focus of our interview today, but it's just so fascinating and you're so knowledgeable. I really like talking with you about it. Diversity, that the D word keeps coming up. Now, prior to Grutter and Gratz, remediation seemed to be the primary reason you're doing. Well, you want to prevent current discrimination, obviously.
Right.
But then to the extent you're looking for other reasons to do what you're doing with affirmative actions to remediate past wrongs.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that argument gets harder and harder to make as time goes on.
Right.
And so diversity as an independent value produced by affirmative action was blessed for the first time, I believe, in the Grutter and Gratz cases. And that's why they're so important.
Yes. The case that the University of Michigan tried to make was that diversity is about educational benefits to all of the students. So it's not just favoring one group at the expense of another.
Right.
But the point was to say, we believe that with a more diverse student body, and that includes race, it includes gender, it includes lots of other characteristics that students bring to the table in the admissions process, that a diverse student body produces educational value for everybody, that we all have something to contribute and we all have something to learn. So it really was based on a positive educational argument rather than looking at the past and trying to right particular wrongs.
I think that's actually a brilliant strategy. Mm-hmm. And I know that the University of Michigan team, which you were part of then, was trying to come up with, coming up with a rationale that would be broader than remediation and that would be permanent rather than temporary.
Yes.
And that would not divide people in camps. Mm-hmm. You know, you against me,
exactly.
Whites against blacks, you know, reverse discrimination and all that. And I was smiling when you were describing it because not only is it a brilliant strategy, but it reminds me, not to trivialize it at all, but it reminds me of my children's kindergarten classes.
Mm-hmm.
We all do better when we all play together.
Exactly.
Everybody's included. You know, we don't exclude little Johnny over there or little Cindy over here simply for whatever reason. Everybody participates and everybody's welcome.
Right.
And that, you know, that's true in kindergarten,
right?
You're supposed to learn in kindergarten to get along with all the kids in the class. Isn't it interesting that we still argue about that when those same kids are in college 20 years later? Thanks for that recap and the update. So we're waiting on the Fisher case to see what the latest iteration of that is. Other than that, I think we should leave affirmative action for the moment because I kind of ambushed you here. We're actually here to talk about something a bit different.
Sure.
And that is now that you've been on the job 3 years, you're in your fourth year already, okay? And you've had a chance to come up with your plan. And your plan, I'm very, very proud and pleased to say, today involves me. That's why I'm here. You've got something called the Madison Vision Series, and I'm honored to be part of it. So what is that? Why am I here today?
We do. Well, when I came to James Madison University, we're, of course, named for the father of the Constitution, and I wanted that relationship to mean something. I wanted to celebrate the living legacy of James Madison and the Constitution. What does it mean as the fundamental framework for our democratic society? So I wanted to raise awareness of James Madison, the person, the man, and of the Constitution. And so the Madison Vision Series is really intended to bring well-known and highly regarded speakers like yourself to campus.
I'm honored.
And we're thrilled that you're here because you, of course, have raised awareness of the Constitution and its continuing relevance and importance in our society. And that's what we talk about in this Vision Series, the big and important issues of our time, policy issues that we are confronted with that create a lot of challenges where there are a lot of differences of opinion. How do we bring people together to learn from one another? And that's obviously what it's all about in a university context. So the Madison Vision Series really does try to shine that light on Madison, the Constitution, and that legacy for us in the 21st century.
Yep. And it's been fantastic just getting ready for it because you and I have been talking about this for months. And we agreed months ago that a good theme for this particular presentation would be Madisonian ethics.
Yes.
What a concept. And it's very, very impressive. And we've already, I don't want to give away the show, but this will actually be broadcast after. So I guess it's okay if we talk a little bit about it. But I've really, really enjoyed researching this. There's always something more to learn about the founding era. There's always something certainly to learn about James Madison. Mm-hmm. And so without getting too much away, I'll simply say that we're going to look both at a situation where Madison maybe fell down a little ethically, and that was on slavery.
Absolutely.
Certainly very controversial, but nuanced, too. It's a much more nuanced, and we'll get into that this afternoon. And then an issue where he acquitted himself a bit better, and that's on the Bill of Rights, because there was a promise there, and a promise that he ultimately kept when others were not necessarily going to. Right. So we have a very interesting discussion of Madison, but then even more fun is that that's only going to be maybe 20 minutes or a half hour. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you and I are going to sit down and do something that I understand you've never done before.
That's correct.
We're going to do some constitutional quizzes.
Yes.
And we're going to bring people up from the audience, and then we're going to record those and put those on the radio show, which is extremely cool.
Yes.
And we've got some really good questions.
We do, and I'm very excited about it. I think it's a great teaching tool to remind people that there's a lot in the Constitution that we don't think about every day. And I think it's important for us periodically as a society and certainly as a university to draw awareness back to what's actually in the Constitution. What are some of the big issues that we've struggled with over the years where there are differences of interpretation and understanding? It's important to recognize it is a living document that has evolved in many respects over the years with our democracy. And I think that's what the Founding Fathers intended. You pointed out the fact that Madison was a human being. He wasn't perfect. He was a brilliant man. He was quite a scholar. He was a real student, which is something that we celebrate at JMU. He did his homework, but he did have flaws, and he certainly was a reflection of his time, as were the other founding fathers. So slavery is the best example where they really struggled with how to handle a difficult issue. They certainly did not come up with perfect solutions, and we know what's happened in U.S. history as a result. But they were also individuals that could find common ground, that worked together across all kinds of differences, that compromised, and who came, I think, to some very important decisions and conclusions that have served our society well.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the middle of a delightful conversation with Jonathan R. Alger, the president of James Madison University in Virginia. I was on campus to give a presentation, the inaugural presentation this year, in something called the Madison Vision Series. And we talk a little bit about that in the interview, but after the break, we'll come back and we'll give you a little taste of that. And then we'll go back and speak some more with Jonathan R. Alger. Stick around. Listening to your weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris. And before we return to my delightful conversation with Jonathan R. Alger, the president of James Madison University, let's hear just a couple of excerpts from the presentation that I recently gave at James Madison University as part of something called the Madison Vision Series. The first voice you hear will be from Maggie Evans, who is the executive assistant to President Alger.
Good afternoon, and happy Constitution Day to everyone here. I'm Maggie Evans from the Office of the President. I'd like to welcome all of you to this semester's first lecture in the Madison Vision Series. 2 years ago, President Alger shared his desire to create a lecture series designed to elevate the discourse on our campus by inviting prominent thinkers and leaders who can help us to look at our current civic landscape from different perspectives and to think about what it means to create and engage an enlightened citizenry as we as an institution work to become the model of an engaged university. I would now like to welcome to the stage JMU President Jonathan Alger to introduce this year's Constitution Day Madison Vision Series speaker. President Alger?
Thank you, Maggie, and good afternoon, everybody. Let's do this again. Happy Constitution Day. It's great to be with all of you, and this really is an auspicious occasion for us to kick off this year's Madison Vision Series. Now, as the Vision Series enters its third year and our country gears up for a presidential election, have you noticed that in 2016, but we're already well on our way there, I do want to point out an exciting trend regarding our speakers in this series. Two of our past Madison Vision Series speakers are now running for President of the United States. In April 2014, Carly Fiorina, a former board member here, served as our final speaker in the inaugural year of the series. And of course, as you know, she is seeking the Republican nomination. You probably saw her on television last night. But to keep things balanced, our 2015 final speaker was Professor Lawrence Lessig, who is now seeking the Democratic nomination. So, while I believe this lecture series would gain momentum and attract important minds to our campus over time, I can honestly say I certainly did not foresee this particular pattern. So, Professor Harris, feel free to make your announcement today. This would be a great occasion, I think, for that on Constitution Day. So, it's with great pleasure that I welcome to the stage Professor Stuart Harris, who will deliver his lecture on Madisonian ethics. Professor Harris.
Well, golly, thank you. Madisonian ethics. Okay, there's this guy. His name was Madison, James Madison. He was kind of ethical. Did you want more than? Oh, okay, yeah, we'll do that. You'll notice that I said kinda. President Alger said something today at lunch that I think we all need to remember. We were talking specifically about Madison, but we then generalized it to all of the people we sometimes call our founders or sometimes our founding fathers or the framers of the Constitution. And what President Alger said was, we need to respect them, but we should avoid revering them. And that's kind of hard to do. Respect them, but not revere them. They're not gods. They're not demigods. We tend to think of them that way, especially when we've got marble busts of them in our offices. In fact, President Alger has a marble bust. So there's a little hypocrisy going on here. And I've told him the next time I'm in his office, I'm going to go over there, I'm going to chip that bust in a couple of places. James Madison was a living, breathing human being, just like you, just like me. Now, I don't have a university named after me. I suspect most of you don't either. So, okay, he's an extraordinary guy, a remarkable guy. He did some really, really cool things. So we need to respect him. But he wasn't perfect. None of the founders was perfect. So let's always remember that whenever we're talking about the founding era. And that's very important when we interpret the Constitution, especially because we tend to look back to that founding era and the people who actually were in Philadelphia in that summer in 1787, or who were part of the ratification process, or maybe who were part of the drafting of the Bill of Rights, and we tend to look back at them. There's even a school of thought, we call it originalism, in interpreting the Constitution, and we tend to deify them. And we tend to do a lot of other things, like thinking they were monolithic. Well, the founders thought this, really? There were 55 people at the convention. There were 39 signatures on the Constitution. 38 people actually signed, because one guy signed for his bud who wasn't there. That's true. That's really true. With permission. I mean, it wasn't a forgery. I know somebody's going to ask me who that was, and I don't remember, so okay, I'm sorry. 39 people who have their names on that. If you had 39 friends over and you asked them what kind of pizza to order, would you get a consensus? Yeah, I didn't think so. And by the way, pineapple on pizza, no. It doesn't happen. Okay, so what we think of these people and how we respect them, or sometimes inappropriately revere them, has great significance in constitutional law. So my subject today is Madison in particular, of all these framers, probably the single most important of them, and his ethics. Ethics are important. Ethics are very much a part of the mission statement of this school, which, by the way, I'm extremely impressed by, and the 8 ethical questions that we're all supposed to ask ourselves before we take any significant action. Ethics are extremely important. And in this, as in everything else, Madison was extraordinary, but not perfect. Not perfect by any means.
And that was a brief excerpt of my recent presentation at James Madison University. I was introduced by Maggie Evans and by Jonathan Alger, the president of JMU. Now it's time to return to my interview with Jonathan Alger. And before the break, we were talking about something that's coming through a lot in this, and that's the imperfection of our founders, because our founders were human beings too. It's so much more interesting to remind ourselves that these were actual living people with actual flaws than it is to carve them in marble.
Yes.
I mean, I like the marble busts. They're very
sure.
Nice. You've got one in your office.
I do.
That's a nice bust, and it's very inspirational. But you might want to put a little couple of warts in there, maybe
yes.
Put a couple of chips in it, and then that would be very helpful, too, to remember
right.
That. Well, that's cool. So that's the Madison Vision series, and this is a series of speeches and presentations that are kicked off every year around this time, Constitution Day, and then they
right.
Go through April.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I guess, the 3rd or 4th year that you've done that,
this
right?
This is, yes. And we're very excited about it. It's drawn people in from the community as well as faculty and staff and students. And it really is intended to spark conversations, and that's what we're hoping to do with it.
Well, I think the quizzes will help.
Yes.
I really do, because we're going to bring people up from the audience. And you're going to sit in for the quiz guy, Doug
mm-hmm.
Smith from Montpelier, who has his own Constitution Day stuff
yes.
To be doing over at Montpelier today. Let's talk a little bit about your relationship with Montpelier. I mean, that seems to me to be, I hesitate to use the term no-brainer, but it seems to me to be so manifest once you realize it. It's only, what, about an hour and a half away?
Exactly.
Just
yes.
Over the mountain, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And with modern conveniences like automobiles, very quick trip over there.
Right.
And since you came here, you established a very close relationship with Montpelier, didn't you?
Yeah, I felt it was really important. Montpelier, of course, is the historic home of James and Dolly Madison and has been beautifully restored in recent years. I felt it was important in coming to James Madison University that we establish that link in an even stronger way. We've certainly worked with them for many years. For example, on archaeology, we've had faculty and students working over at Montpelier doing archaeological work, and it's been a tremendous learning
opportunity. I've got to interrupt you.
Yes.
Did you see the recent story? I mean, it just came out about a young lady. I think she is from Detroit, from my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
She's an African-American,
mm-hmm.
and she volunteered for one of their digs. And realized as she was researching Montpelier that she is a direct descendant of the Gilmores, whose slave cabin
yeah.
is still preserved at Montpelier.
Oh.
So she found a direct and personal connection with that history and is now actually finding artifacts over there.
Yeah,
it is such a cool thing.
That's an amazing example. And when you think about a living legacy and how we are directly linked to the founding fathers and to that period, what a great example and an important part of the story. And that's something I appreciate about Montpelier is you talked about the warts, and they do talk about the legacy of slavery as well and what that looked like at the time. So I think it's important that they try to tell the whole story. And you know, one of the things that I also appreciate about Montpelier, it's not just a historic site, but they really are an educational institution. So part of our relationship is to bring attention to James and Dolly Madison as real people, and also to the Constitution as a living document. So we've had a lot of efforts that we've worked on together to bring attention to the Constitution today, to raise awareness, working with K-12 teachers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I participated in a wonderful civics salon a couple of years ago with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, in fact, was there, at Montpelier. We've worked on a lesson plan competition in civics education for K-12 teachers together. I've spoken at Montpelier. We've had their CEO on our campus as part of this Madison Vision series.
Right, Kat Imhoff was there.
Exactly.
That's right.
And she's been a terrific partner for us. The Marching Royal Dukes, our marching band, has even performed at Montpelier to try to show the ties in a different and fun way. So I think there's a lot that we can do as we continue to focus on James and Dolly Madison and on the Constitution together.
Tremendous. Absolutely. Well, you know, the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution actually underwrites this show. So we'd like to plug them whenever we
Absolutely.
Can.
Absolutely. They do great work.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, that brings us actually to what I told you before this interview was actually going to be our focus, which was your broader vision for James Madison University. And you've been kind enough to share with me a marvelous pamphlet that states your mission. Mm-hmm. And states to a great extent how you envision achieving it. And you've come up with an entire new approach that I think that the key word of which is engagement.
Yes.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So we start with a mission statement as a university that says that we are a community, and that's a key word, that prepares educated and enlightened citizens who will lead productive and meaningful lives. And each of those words really matters to us as an institution. So we see our role as really producing students who will be the change, who will be active and engaged citizens in a representative democracy. Yes, we want them to have great jobs and careers, but it's much more than that. We also want them to use their gifts, their skills, their education to make a difference in the world. So when I arrived at the university, I said we really need to have a strategic planning process that's inclusive, that reflects the community that we are, the growing diversity that we have at our institution, and to come together and think about the future. And so we developed a new vision statement in that process that talks about being the national model of the engaged university, engaged with ideas and the world. And that those two pieces are important. It's not just about learning in the classroom. It's how we apply that knowledge outside the classroom. And we identified three important components of engagement that we can talk more about: engaged learning, community engagement, and civic engagement. And those are the three core components that we are now thinking about as we go forward, how to bring them to life for everybody in our university community.
Engaged learning, community engagement, and civic engagement. Okay, three major components. How do these differ? How do you define them? What are the? I mean, we know they all share engagement, but how do they differ?
Right. So, starting with engaged learning, which is really the foundation for everything that we do at the university, the idea here is that learning is an active, not a passive process at James Madison University. We talk about high impact learning practices that really transform students' lives, the way they think, the way they approach problems. So these are things that involve relationships, close relationships of students with each other and with faculty, both in and outside the classroom. They can include things like having debate in classes and teamwork and team projects, internships and externships, which are experiential so that you can apply your learning outside the classroom, experience with diversity and bringing that out in various ways, study abroad. So these are what we call high impact practices that we have a lot of evidence that shows these are really transformative experiences for students that allow them to apply their learning to new challenges and new situations that they'll find themselves in.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a tough question on this one because I've been around a lot of faculties, and I know there are a lot of crusty old faculty members that look kind of like me. Did you get any of the following reaction? I've been teaching my class this way for 40 years, and I'm not going to change it.
Well, you know, there's always some discussion and debate, which is healthy within a faculty. That's what we do in higher education, right?
That's a very politic response, John. And I can see why you're the president.
what I can tell you is that this wasn't something brand new to JMU. Mm-hmm. Part of the idea of this vision statement and our strategic plan was that it reflected who we already are, and then also to talk about and what we can become. How do we build on the strengths that we have as an institution? So what I saw when I got here was lots of great examples of engaged learning happening all across the campus. Students in laboratories doing undergraduate research with faculty, students that were studying abroad all over the world, students that were working with each other on team projects and classes. But what we hadn't necessarily done was to really take a step back and look at the university as a whole and say, What is the big picture here of what we're trying to accomplish for all of our students, and how can we be systematic about that across all of the disciplines? The idea was that it was inclusive of everybody, and that it's not the same in art or in history or in English as it might be in biology or psychology. So every academic unit has a role to play in thinking about what engaged learning means to them. I think the faculty were actually energized and excited. It took a while to get everybody to understand what we meant by engaged learning, but I think once they saw that, yes, this is something that we are involved with, that we already do in many respects, but we need to be more intentional about it and more focused on providing this experience for all of our students, I think that really helped to get the buy-in. And we had a lot of faculty involved throughout that process on the committees that developed these concepts.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the middle of a delightful conversation with Jonathan R. Alger, the president of James Madison University in Virginia. I was on campus to give a presentation, and part of that presentation was some quizzes. And so after the break, we're going to play one of them for you. Stick around. Hey, let's do some quizzes, shall we? Let's get some people up here. Okay, all right. Tremendous. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, now this is the audience participation section. If we don't have any contestants, we're just going to be really boring. Okay? So, we need some people to come down front, and as an incentive, every contestant gets a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, and they're going to be prepared for you and ready right afterward by the beautiful Danielle. Stand up. There's the beautiful Danielle. Wave at the camera. Everybody. Yeah, yeah, thank you, Danielle. Okay. She's got a constitution for everybody, and she's got T-shirts with that cool logo on it. No, not that guy. The blue one. From the radio show. So if you come down and you take the quiz and you win, you get a T-shirt. Now, come on. All right, we have a brave one. Tremendous.
All right. People want to start lining up.
I have to go to the microphone, please.
Yes.
To the microphone. We all have to hear you. Oh, tremendous. We got a few contestants here.
Oh, very good.
Okay, who's going to be first?
I'll be first.
Tremendous. Speak into the microphone, please. Who are you, sir?
I'm Rex Fuller. I'm a retired professor, which means I'm very much out of date, and that's why I come.
That's perfect. We're happy to have you, Professor Fuller. We're very happy to have you indeed. So you taught here at JMU?
I did.
What did you teach?
Students. But
okay, very good. Excellent. And what kind of stuff?
Speech communication, rhetoric, and public address.
How did I guess that? I think this guy's comfortable in a microphone.
He is.
Okay. Do you mind if I call you Rex?
Absolutely.
Okay. You do mind?
I don't.
Okay. Rex, have at it. Oh, well, no. We're not. It's up to you.
Yes.
Because normally I started the show with the quiz lady. She left Montpelier to have a baby. Yay. Okay. So now we go with Doug Smith, the head of the center for the Constitution. He's the quiz guy. He's not here today. They're doing their own thing at Montpelier. So today we have the quiz prez. And the quiz prez, with the help of some of his excellent, excellent staff, notably Bill Wilson. Thank
yes,
you very
thank
much,
you,
Bill.
Bill.
Has come up with some really tough questions. So, Rex, quiz prez, have at it.
Okay, Rex, you ready for this? Now listen very carefully. This is, I'm sure, the hardest question of this group. And multiple choice, okay? Who is considered the father of the Constitution? Now here are your choices. A, Benjamin Franklin. B, George Washington. C, James Monroe. Or D, James Madison.
Okay, we're not giving him a T-shirt for that.
Bill wrote the questions.
What is up with this, Bill? Come on.
I realized in my introduction I actually gave away the answer, too. But that's
those T-shirts cost money, Bill.
Yes. Maybe we should ask him which two of these individuals ran against each other for a congressional seat. That might be a...
Well, let's let him answer this one, right, and then I have a follow-up question. But go on, please.
What was the question? I think the answer is probably the namesake of this great university.
James Madison. Correct, sir. Correct.
Yay.
Well said. Correct.
Now, wait a second. You want a t-shirt? Here's your follow-up question. What is the name of James Madison's stepson's horse? Oh, I didn't think you knew that. Too bad for you. Go on up there, and the lovely Danielle will give you your prize. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we just heard the first live quiz that we've ever recorded. It was at my during my recent visit to James Madison University, and the quiz guy was actually the quiz prez, President Alger of James Madison University. And now it's time to finish our conversation with John.
There are a lot of classes in at the law school level that lend themselves to lots of group assignments, to teamwork, to competition, to debate, to projects outside the classroom together. Then there are other classes that maybe don't, that maybe, you know, the simple volume of material that needs to be covered. And, you know, we have, we get tested on all this. We have a bar exam.
Yes,
well, you know that. You know that. I mean, there's a certain amount of material you've got to cover.
Right.
And I happen at the moment, though I've taught both types of classes, at the moment I happen to teach two courses that are very much of the latter type. I think there are ways to get engagement even in a big lecture course. And one technique that I like to use is to invite comment at frequent intervals. In fact, I typically begin each class by simply saying, okay, we're studying this, this, and this. You recall we ended up here. Now, does anyone have any questions about anything we've covered thus far? And I'll actually ask it two or three times into the silence until somebody volunteers. And then you find that if one person has a question, others did too.
Right.
And then if you encourage that enough, then you start getting questions of, on their own. I'm not one of these people that likes that really intense Socratic dialogue where it can be intimidating. I think that's counterproductive. But I think that if you can encourage students to ask questions, they start to feel comfortable with you asking questions. Then even in a lecture format, you get much more interactivity and much more engagement. And so I think there are ways to do this even in traditional classes.
Absolutely. And that's part of the message that we wanted to get across because, of course, we are a large university with 20,000 students. We do have large lecture classes as well as lots of small seminars and labs and other types of courses. And we wanted the faculty to think about how can you think about engagement regardless of the size of the class or the type of class that you're teaching. And in fact, we do have some nationally recognized faculty who do precisely what you're talking about.
Yeah, you've won a couple of awards, or I should say your faculty has. I mean, there's a statewide award I knew.
Yes.
I know that every year there's like a teacher of the year at the university level, and I've seen JMU come up several times.
Absolutely, yes. The State Council has recognized a number of our faculty for their teaching, and that's part of what we pride ourselves on at James Madison University is the faculty who are here really care about teaching and developing relationships with their students, both in and outside the classroom. So we really, we look for faculty members who are going to come and have that kind of focus. The students are drawn to the university because of that. And so I think that makes the learning process very active and exciting. And that is really what it's all about with engagement. It's not that you're just sitting back taking notes, that we want you to be asking questions. We want there to be discussion and dialogue and debate. We have a Center for Faculty Innovation that works with faculty to help them to think about how they teach and what they teach and how to make it more engaging. And so that's another key resource that we have. We don't just say to faculty, figure it out, but we have resources to help them.
Now, amid all your other duties, and I know there are many, do you find the opportunity to teach while you're here?
I do indeed. I'm actually co-teaching an honor seminar on leadership again this semester. It's a lot of fun. And as a president, I think it's really important to be directly engaged with your own students. It's a reminder of why we're here in the university. And I really love doing it. And we try to practice what we preach. So we have a lot of engaged learning practices in our class. For example, we incorporate debate. We work with the leaders of the Madison Debate Club who are experts in how to do this and get the students drawn in. For many of them, it's the first time they've had that kind of experience. We have a service learning project where students are working in the community and then reflecting on what that experience meant to them. And they have individual projects and a lot of teamwork. We actually divide the class into teams based on different personality characteristics. So the students learn a lot
test at the beginning?
We do. They take sort of like a Myers-Briggs type of analysis so that
And then you put them
And then we put them together in teams that we hope will be diverse and that will bring different perspectives to the table.
Very, very nice. Well, that's very nice. Well, we could talk about this all day, but there are two other components of engagement that you're pushing now. So what about this community engagement? Yeah.
So the idea of community engagement is to say that we are not an isolated ivory tower, that our vision for higher education is to make an impact on the world. And we don't want students just to wait until after they graduate to do that. So a big part of what we encourage our students to do is to work with the community around them at all levels. That might be locally, it might be around the state, around the country, or even around the world. For example, when they're in study abroad experiences, to work with people and organizations around them to try to address the major challenges of our time. So for example, locally, we have hundreds of students who serve as big brothers and big sisters in that,
program.
Mm-hmm. We have students who serve as mentors to students in the K-12 schools through our New Valley Scholars program. When students are studying abroad, for example, in Florence, where I visited recently, we have students who are teaching English to underprivileged Italian students in the public schools in Florence while they're on study abroad. So we think
that's really laudable, John, but let's be honest now. Did you do the Florence thing just because you knew you'd have to go on an inspection trip?
Well, it's a tough job, but someone's got to do it, right? But no, it's a fabulous experience for our students. But we do, you know, even when students are studying abroad, we don't want it just to be go and admire the beautiful sights, as great as a place like Florence is, but really to understand the culture and the context in which you're in. And that's part of, I think, what students get the most out of when they come back and talk about it. I think the chance to meet real people and to interact with them is one of the highlights.
It is indeed. Now, when you say encourage community involvement, does that mean that you encourage faculty to incorporate it in their classes, or does it mean that you actually have some sort of extracurricular credit they can get for doing this? I mean, how do you concretely encourage them to do this?
Yes. So we actually have an office that focuses on community service and service learning, and they actually work with faculty in all the different academic units to help them incorporate this into their teaching. So for example, in the class that I co-teach, I knew I was not an expert in how to do this well. So we went to them and said, help us to think about how to incorporate this into our leadership curriculum, how to come up with leadership experiences where the students are working in our community. And then the important part of it from a learning perspective is the students have to reflect on the experience, what they learned from it, what went well, what didn't go well. So yet again, it's an example where we have resources to help faculty incorporate this into their teaching. But it's also on the extracurricular front as well. We have lots of student organizations and student-led initiatives with community service. So we have something we call the Big Event every year where hundreds of students volunteer locally and regionally. There are dozens of projects, and many faculty and staff also participate. That's something that the students really pride themselves on, that they take a leadership role, that they are involved and engaged. They meet a lot of people. They understand the needs of the community better than ever before. And once they have that kind of experience, they crave more of it, and they realize that they are part of a community that's larger than themselves.
You're right about that last point, especially once you do something like that, once you work with little kids, for example, you want to go back. That's the best part of your week.
Absolutely.
It's just, you know, you might get a little irritated occasionally. Oh, gosh, it's 3 and I've got to get over there and I'm late and I've got this other stuff to do. But I tell you what, whenever I've participated in that, as soon as I walk in the door, the particular project I'm thinking of is I used to read The Hobbit to a bunch of fourth graders. There's nothing better than sitting down in a big chair with a bunch of fourth graders and reading about Bilbo Baggins.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do that once, and then you're going to go back. And one other benefit, of course, that comes to mind is that that's wonderful for relationships between JMU as an institution and the surrounding community. There's always a town and gown friction.
Sure.
And I bet that that lubricates that friction a great deal, doesn't it?
It does. In fact, one of the things we did symbolically shortly after I became president of the university, we had an event where the students walked from our campus to the heart of downtown Harrisonburg, where we're located, and we presented the keys to the university to the city and the county. So sort of the opposite of what often happens. And it was very deliberate to say, we want our doors to be open to the community. We want the community to be on our campus, and we want people from our campus to be in the community as well. And I can't tell you how many times I've had people in the community thank me for the tremendous work that our faculty and staff and students are doing in the community. For example, not too long ago, I visited one of the local fire stations where a very large number of their volunteers are JMU students. So they are emergency responders. They're working in all sorts of ways in the schools and other aspects of the community to make life better for all of us.
It's just fantastic. That brings us to the last of the three big ones, and this is civic engagement, the area that I'm working mostly in, and I understand it's also near and dear to your heart. So what about civic engagement?
It is. Well, when I came to JMU, I said, look, a lot of schools now are understanding engaged learning and doing more of that, and community engagement as well. But this third component for us was very important as part of our identity. We are, of course, named for the father of the Constitution, and I wanted that to mean something for all of our faculty and staff and students. And the idea of civic engagement for us is that it's not just about what are your rights as citizens in a democracy, but what are your responsibilities as citizens? And that's a really important part of what we're trying to teach our students. How can you be an engaged citizen? How can you make a difference? Whatever major you're in, it might be in health policy if you're working in that area. Mm-hmm. As a scientist, there are a lot of important scientific issues that we debate in public policy and where you can make a difference. Obviously, history majors and teachers can be very involved in a civic way. So we try to get students in all disciplines to think about how they can use their skills and talents and to engage in the democratic society in which we live, not to just be cynical about government, not just to assume that it's somebody else's job, but to recognize that the Founding Fathers thought for this experiment to work, the citizens needed to be educated and they needed to be involved. And so that's what we try to talk about and strive for with all of our students.
You mentioned cynic. That's one of the most irritating things I ever hear. They're all the same. There's no point in participating. Well, you've just abdicated the whole experiment.
Exactly.
They're not all the same. I mean, sure, there's lots of failings in our politicians. Right. They're human beings. Right. Well, then go out and run yourself.
Exactly.
You know, go out and get involved. In fact, I understand that there was a major initiative here, wasn't there, about voting districts or something in Harrisonburg?
Indeed. So this was a great example of our students in action. What I find is our students actually have a hunger for this, that they actually want to be involved in something larger than themselves, that they don't want to give up on society, that they do want to make a difference. So what happened recently is a number of our students, led by people in student government, came together and said, we want to increase the percentage of students who are voting. As you know, that's a big challenge.
Huge issue, because if they're registered at all, which they might not be because it's new, they're registered back home, wherever home is.
Exactly. And so many of them simply don't vote in college. Right. And if you don't establish that pattern early, it's not likely later on that they're necessarily going to vote regularly. So the students came together and said, as they have at many other campuses, we want to have a voting precinct on campus. And they worked through the process. They actually made presentations to the city council. And there were different points of view that were expressed. And the students stood up and made well-reasoned arguments, participated in the debate, and ultimately were successful. So we will now have a voting precinct on campus. And of course, the next step now is to get students to register and get them out to vote. We also, by the way, will have some community members who will vote with us at that precinct, which I think is also very exciting in terms of the town-gown relationship. But here you had a student-led initiative that the students said, this is important, we need to do better, and the students are taking the lead in talking to their colleagues to say, you've got to register, you've got to vote, and you've got to educate yourself about the big issues of the day.
That's tremendous, because something you said there just really sticks in my mind. You've got to get into the habit of voting early.
Yes.
And it's extremely important, and it's so easy not to do it. And especially if you've got the excuse of, oh, I'm registered back home, and I'm here on campus, and I can't get home in time to vote. Right. You've essentially just eliminated an excuse for a lot of students.
Absolutely.
So what excuse do they have not to register now?
Right.
And not to show up on the next election day?
Right. And I think it was important that the students took the leadership role on this front, that they recognized they are the future of this country. And while we can all complain about the problems that we face and the shortcomings of our politicians, they are people. And the future leaders are going to be people, too. And our students are that next generation of leaders. And so one of the things that JMU really strives to do is to get students to think about their potential and their positive ability to affect change in society. So yes, you will identify and learn about some of the big challenges of our time, problems that need to be solved, but there's an awful lot that you can do to make a difference and that you need to take leadership and responsibility. And by the way, we're all going to be counting on you to do perhaps a better job than our generations have done.
Indeed, indeed. Well, something else you mentioned there, that, you know, another benefit of this, this is a state institution, right?
Yes.
In fact, it's a very large state institution. Mm-hmm. And if this works, and if you get a lot of JMU grants to go into politics, and if you can pack the Virginia General Assembly with JMU grads, then that's going to guarantee your budget for the next week.
That would be wonderful, yes.
This is part of a grand strategy, isn't it? Yes, okay, you've got ulterior motives.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned the future, so and we're running out of time here, so okay. What do you see? I mean, you've only been on campus a little over 3 years right. now. What does the future hold?
Right. Well, I'm very excited about the process we've already been through. I started with a listening tour to help develop the strategic
plan. An international listening tour.
It was indeed, yes.
You went and found JMU people around the world?
Alumni all over the world. Mm-hmm. We have, for example, a new chapter in London. There are JMU...
Oh, that's another tough duty, isn't it? It's just
was.
Terrible.
This job is challenging in all sorts of
just
ways.
Just horrible, okay.
So we started with a very deliberate process that was inclusive, that brought a lot of voices to the table, developed a plan that I think everybody can take ownership of, that we can all feel a part of. And now the challenge is how to operationalize it, how to achieve that aspiration to be a national model of the engaged university, engaged with ideas and the world. Mm-hmm. We certainly have a lot of building blocks in place. A lot of great things are happening. But now the conversations are happening across the entire university and all the academic units to say, how do we make this really come to life? And how do we tell the story so that people understand what we're doing? And finally, we're looking very carefully at assessment and accountability. We take that very seriously. The value proposition for higher education is a big question in a lot of people's minds these days. Is it worth it to send my son or daughter to a college like JMU? Are they going to get the education that people are talking about? What are they really going to learn? And so that's a big part of the puzzle, too, is developing measures and metrics to demonstrate that it's actually working, that students are learning what we say they should be learning. And that's going to be a very important part as we look toward the future to make sure that at every turn we're assessing the student learning outcomes.
Well, that's an excellent point. In fact, I'm remembering something now. I majored in public affairs years and years ago at a place called the Wilson School at Princeton. And at a certain point, I started getting surveys, and they were asking me what I was doing. And I thought, well, that's awfully nice, because normally you just get things asking for money, right?
Right.
And then I realized they were really trying to establish a database of how many of their students, who at least in theory were interested in public affairs, had actually gone into public affairs.
Exactly.
So they were very interested, are you an elected official, or have you ever run for office, or an appointed official, or have you simply worked in the public sector for government or whatever else? And so that may be something that you might want to think about doing, is doing these systematic surveys. You know, once you've figured out what you'd like your students to be engaged in, maybe asking them if they've been engaged in those things.
Absolutely. And a lot of this actually does involve the alumni over time, because we know that you plant seeds in higher education, and sometimes it takes years for those seeds to come to fruition. So the intergenerational connections, that's actually an important part of the strategic plan going forward. We want to continue to be in touch with the alumni to find out how their education has impacted them over time, and then also to have them engaged working with our students, working with our faculty to share their experiences, what worked, what could be improved upon. They're a very important resource for us. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about that. Well, John Alger, the president of James Madison University, the guy with the plan. Thank you very, very much for sharing it with us. And maybe we'll come back in a few years. We can do an assessment, see how things are going.
That would be terrific. Thank you so much, Stuart, for your time as well.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Jonathan R. Alger, the president of JMU, for inviting me to be part of the Madison Vision series, and also for being such a good sport as the quiz prez. Thanks also to his executive assistant, Maggie Evans, and to Bill Wilson, the director of the Madison Institutes at JMU, who has been so helpful throughout this process, and who's my old buddy from We the People. Thanks also to Tom Carr and Jamie Woolery of the Forbes Center, where the live portions of this show were recorded. If you've never been to the Forbes Center at JMU, you need to go. Those guys know what they're doing. Matt Bingay from WMRA also gets special thanks because, of course, he recorded our interview that was featured today with John Alger. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.